From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The Biden administration has an idea to help pay for the president's $2 trillion infrastructure bill. It has unveiled a new tax plan with a provision to eliminate fossil fuel subsidies and replace them with incentives to produce clean energy. It's part of the administration's larger climate strategy, which includes eliminating all carbon emissions from power generation by 2035. Gina McCarthy is National Climate Advisor to the White House, and she joins me now. Gina McCarthy, welcome.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me, Peter.
Sure. And which fossil fuel subsidies is the administration targeting here? Is it all of them?
Well, we're taking a look at what the direct fossil fuel subsidies are, and we're going to list them and take a look at them, and we're going to eliminate them. I think it's really important for us to send a signal about where our economy is heading, where our opportunities are, and what we need to do to provide a sustainable and resilient future for the people in this country and beyond. And we're going to be committed to do that through the budget that we propose and the actions that we intend to take.
Oil and gas companies are calling that a job killer. Aside from raising the money for the infrastructure bill, what's the practical effect on the industry of ending those subsidies?
It's hard for me to tell specifically, but I do know that these companies remain competitive. I do expect that fossil fuels will be around for a while, but I think it's more than appropriate for us to take a look at subsidies that have been in place for as long as these have without a second look. And so we should be looking at both limiting unnecessary advances through our stipends that we're handing to these companies, and instead look at opportunities to make sure that they're doing their job correctly and we're shifting our investments to the future.
So if you can get that through Congress, it may help you reach one of the major goals of this infrastructure bill, which comes along with a new clean energy standard, which means 100% carbon-free power generation in this country by 2035. Is that negotiable?
Actually, the clean energy standard is one tool of many that's going to allow us to advance clean energy. A clean energy standard has worked in states before. It sends clear signals about where the power sector can begin to continue to sort of do their work, but to do it in a way that's very focused on what we need to achieve by 2035 and how to get there in a way that keeps the lights on and keeps our energy reliable and affordable.
You say it's worked in some states, but mm-hmm. It might be more challenging in others. As you know, every state's energy portfolio is very different. Some are far more heavy on coal and natural gas. So how do you get there and make it work so that a clean energy standard is realistic for all 50 states?
So we have not framed the clean energy standard. We are looking to talk to folks on the Hill, and we'll hopefully reach a good understanding of how best to move this forward. And I fully expect we'll be able to learn lessons from what's happened in the past, and we'll be able to have a national standard that's flexible enough that we can get to the reductions in greenhouse gas emissions we're looking for in a clean energy future, but do it in a way with our eyes wide open about both state and regional economies, as well as the national goals we're looking to achieve.
When you say you're working with people on the Hill, if a few mm-hmm. Republicans came to you and said, look, if you make this 90% renewable by 2050, we'll work with you. What do you say?
Well, we're turning absolutely no ideas away. We already are in conversations with utilities. We're already in conversations with folks on the Hill. And so we're just going to continue these conversations in a way that hopefully provides Congress the level of certainty they need that any congressional bill is proposed in a way that can get over the finish line. And part of the American Jobs bill is going to be all about making sure that the investments are made in our electricity sector, looking at the transmission lines we're going to make. So these are not conflicted and just unilaterally about a state or a region, but we have national flexibility that's going to allow us to achieve this in a way that keeps energy affordable
Okay, but that focus is part of what's driving Republicans away. Now, the president has repeatedly said he's willing to work with conservatives, but many don't believe it because there's already talk of passing this bill with budget reconciliation, which means you'd only need Democratic support. Is the president being honest when he says he's going to work across the aisle?
Well, I think you have to look at what's already happened to make that determination, Peter. He's already had two bipartisan meetings in the White House. He has already sent five of his cabinet members on the Hill meeting with Republicans and Democrats to talk about the specifics. There is no question that Joe Biden, as a vice president and as a senator, worked across the aisle consistently, and he's not changing his stripes now.
Why talk about reconciliation already then?
Well, I think that conversation has come up on each side and in many different occasions, and I think it always will because it is an issue that's on the table. It deserves to be considered. But the one thing that everybody here in the White House is unwilling to do is nothing. And right now, we don't see alternatives being put on the table by the Republicans. We see a lot of grumblings and concerns. But if they have concerns, let them express it. Let them put new alternatives on the table. And we'll see where this goes. That's how democracy works. All sides have to contribute, not just sit on the sidelines.
Gina McCarthy, National Climate Advisor to the White House. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Peter.
Well, to COVID now, a recent NPR Marist poll showed that one out of four Americans would refuse a vaccine if offered. Now, some of those are anti-vaxxers. They probably will never take the vaccine. But some are vaccine hesitant. They aren't sure if it works or they can't get through bureaucracy. The Kaiser Family Foundation says 22% of people polled are in this category. So how to reach them? Let's bring back Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo, epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins University. And Dr. Nuzzo, we just want to spend a few minutes on this because our friends at STAT, the health publication, reported that surveys show Black and Hispanic adults are more likely to be waiting to see before they get a vaccine, also less likely to say they definitely won't take one than white adults. In other words, they're not anti-vaxxers, they're hesitant. How to reach them?
Sure. Well, I think the important thing is to recognize that hesitancy is not necessarily a fixed state and that through education and engagement and crucially increasing access, I think we can make some progress in getting more vaccines into arms and people who may have, initially said that they were hesitant. One of the challenges we know is that not all communities have the same ease with which they can access vaccines. And, you know, if you bring vaccines to people, if you have them in the community, and if you have those efforts led by community groups that can help get people scheduled for their appointments and talk about the vaccines, you know, that can go a long way to getting people from that maybe initial state of discomfort to ultimately signing up.
Well, and those who are hesitant because, well, we're hearing anecdotally about someone's dad who can't make his way through the website or the phone call. He just said, you know what, I'm just not going to do it. I suppose it's different state to state, but I guess what's the most important thing to help someone get access?
Right. Well, I think it's going to get easier. Initially, it was largely led by states. And so you had this situation where you had to sign up on multiple lists. And it was, you know, a question of having to refresh the website every single day at certain times. I mean, that's just not something that everybody can manage with the same ease. As we have more vaccines available and there are more providers who are able to give it, I think it'll just be easier for people to navigate the system. So hopefully that will help. But I think also we have to have conversations with people about the value of the vaccine and the importance of getting vaccinated as soon as they can.
Well, you know, they mentioned that and they say that when they talk to people like you, it has to be a gentle conversation because these are, again, not people who are adamant for one reason or the other. They have fear. They have hesitancy. So listen first, we're hearing.
Listen first and also recognize that it's natural that people would feel hesitant. They've heard lots of different things about the virus and the vaccine. We've called the vaccine development process warp speed that, you know, probably leaves a lot of question in people's minds. I've done a lot of sessions talking to people, and usually if you approach them with empathy and just are there to provide information, I feel like by the end of the conversation, we're in a much different place.
Yeah, probably mocking someone who's just afraid would not be a good idea. But another big problem is the hesitancy in the Latino community because not only are inoculation rates low, but misinformation in Spanish is high. Rumors that the vaccines contain microchips or will alter DNA or are part of satanic rituals. This is all spreading on social media. So language barriers have to be overcome.
Yeah, that's a big problem because public health agencies typically don't have the kind of language or translation services that are needed to combat that. So that's really where partnership with community groups that serve those communities, that are trusted by those communities, that can help translate public health information in an accessible way, but also in the languages that the community needs. Those are really critical.
Yeah, again, just a reminder that hesitancy is not adamancy. Is that a word? I think I just made it up. It's not an anti-vaxxer. It's someone who's just a little scared. Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo, epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins University. Thank you, as always.
Thank you so much.
The UK is still embroiled in a debate launched last week by the release of that government report that concluded that while outright racism does exist in Britain, the country is not institutionally racist or rigged against ethnic minorities and should be a model for other white majority countries. The Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities was formed after last year's anti-racism protests. 9 out of 10 of the members are from ethnic groups, but people of color in Britain in particular bristled at their conclusion that geography, background, social class had a bigger impact than race on people's lives. A very vocal critic has been Kayende Andrews, a professor of Black Studies at Birmingham City University. He joins us now by Skype. And Professor, just start. What bothered you about the report?
Well, I think everything. To be honest, when the commission was compiled last year, they picked a bunch of institutional racism deniers who went on to deny that institutional racism exists. So it's not really a surprise, and I don't think anybody is taking it all that seriously.
Well, give us some examples of what you saw in the report conflicted with the reality you see.
Well, I think the headline that there is no institutional racism is the big one, if you look at all of the stats and evidence, which actually, strangely, is in the report. They've somehow just managed to come to the conclusion that it doesn't mean it's racism.
Well, yes, we should say the report points out that there is racism, but that it's not institutional. And this is why some of your writing is fascinating to us, because if I've got this right, you know, this idea of seeing people in previously all white workplaces is not to you a sign that there's no racism. Inclusivity isn't your biggest concern. You're the child of Black activists, part of a community that started newspapers and Saturday school for Black children. You just became UK's first professor of Black Studies in 2017. But you say white institutions and Blacks who come up through white institutions aren't going to change. Real change can't come from elite institutions. And it's people of color who should get back to nurturing separate organizations. Can you tell us more about that, about how people might think they're seeing that racism has ended when they see people of color in previously elite, well, like you, at a university?
Yeah. I really, of all ironies, I've often used as the example that things have changed. And the problem is that we've confused, and the report confuses, individual prejudice, which has no doubt declined. Like, you know, my parents experienced a kind of racism which I just have never experienced in my life. As you said, I am the first professor of Black Studies. In fact, there are only 140 full professors who are Black in the whole entire country. Somebody said, like, make sure we don't all get on a plane at the same time, because literally, if something goes wrong, there'll be none of us left. It's a bit sad, but it's also true, right? What's happened is, and my family is part of this movement of Black power, and few of us have managed to have some success. But that isn't how you measure racism. You have to look at the broader picture. And if you look at education, health, criminal justice, it's just as bad as it's ever been. And that's why people are so upset about this report, because it just doesn't chime with the reality of being Black in Britain.
Well, you layer on more modern issues like frontline workers in a pandemic are largely people of color, something we're also looking at here in the United States.
Yeah, and I think that's like, I mean, this is why, again, people are quite mad, is because we've just had a big protest of Black Lives Matter in the UK as well. And if you look at COVID, the disproportionality, I mean, the fact that Black people do live, tend to live, just like in America, we are hugely residentially segregated into the inner cities. We do tend to be in public-facing frontline workers. The idea that that means that geography and class are more important than race, frankly, is astounding, given that you can't explain the geography and class without talking about race, right?
No. Well, the report made 24 recommendations. Among them, build trust, promote fairness, create agency, achieve inclusivity, which we've just talked about, create partnerships between police and communities. And what would you ask be done?
Well, I think we have to start taking these issues far more seriously. I mean, one of the other problems of the report is the tone of it really is that we just need to stop complaining. It's all about trying to build trust with the police, for example. Actually, if we understand what the problems are, the police are the problem. There's no reason to trust the police force that disproportionately stops black people, arrests us at higher rates, charges us at higher rates, and it leads to much higher rates of incarceration. This is the whole purpose of the concept of institutional racism, is to say we need to fix these institutions before you can expect communities to trust them.
That's Kayende Andrews, professor of Black Studies at Birmingham City University. His new book is The New Age of Empire. Thank you so much, professor, for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, here in this country, an influential medical journal is having a racial reckoning of its own. The Journal of the American Medical Association released a podcast on structural racism in medicine that created so much outrage it had to be removed from JAMA's website. Usha Lee McFarlane wrote about this. She's a national science correspondent with our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Usha, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So the podcast featured two white doctors, and they were both top editors at JAMA. But the criticism is largely falling on the host. Why? What happened here?
Well, they ran a podcast for physicians to learn about structural racism. They brought no experts on the topic, and for critics, they said this sort of exemplifies what structural racism is all about, their voices being left out, the topic not being taken seriously. If they had done any other topic, even so, whether glaucoma or lung cancer, they would have certainly had experts. For this topic, they did not.
That, of course, offended people very much. Brittany James at the University of Illinois College of Medicine actually started a petition after this calling for restructuring of the editorial staff at JAMA. What are she and others saying about JAMA's problems with race, which, by the way, predate this podcast?
They do. They're really upset. I think that many people feel like it's been weeks, months, years of these journals not taking seriously issues of racism in medicine that are harming people. But the podcast, I think, made people so angry that they were finally able to speak out. And I believe it's now 8,000 people, many of them physicians, have signed that petition and are publicly putting their name on their outrage.
We've heard from your reporting that editors at JAMA would also go as far as to ask authors who submitted papers to replace the word racism with terms that white doctors wouldn't find as offensive.
Yeah, and I'm hearing from more and more people who are now contacting me to say, yeah, they were told, can we call this bias, or can we say it's social factors that, you know, make people sicker? And they're so upset about that because it's like, if you can't even say the word out loud, how can you start to make changes against it? And they say this also is just a clear example of structural racism, which was exhibited in the podcast where the host said, you know, racism, the word makes people uncomfortable. Should we even use it? And that really, I think, was the point that made people probably the most upset.
And what about the practice that you reported on as well, that if an author had submitted a paper that was about race, they would be encouraged to make it an editorial as opposed to a peer-reviewed article? What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's a real problem. What researchers are saying, sometimes their work is just rejected outright as not important or not critical and not worthy of publication as in the journals. Or they're told, that's interesting. Why don't you make it a perspective, you know? They're kind of the second tier of publication. And so this, they say, is like a clear indication of the work being dismissed or devalued in the eyes of journal editors.
So if you're not in medicine, you probably didn't hear this podcast, but you also might be wondering, you know, why does it matter? So could you explain that? You know, these journals, I mean, they affect the way that doctors treat their patients, people of color. I mean, it does matter in the clinical setting even, doesn't it?
These really do matter. These are journals that physicians, not only in America, but in the world, look to for education, for leadership. They set the priorities for what research should be done. And I was thinking, it's almost like if editors said, you know, we don't think lung cancer is important. We don't want to publish research on that. You know, then people wouldn't talk about it. They wouldn't research it. The field wouldn't get pushed forward. And that's why people feel this is really like clinically dangerous. We know from, you know, the National Academy of Medicine and other reports that black and brown patients in the United States die at much higher rates of literally every disease. And that's due to structural racism. And if we can't start researching it, talking about it, saying the word out loud, you know, how are we going to improve our medical system?
The other thing here, Usha, is that these journals are very important to the careers of doctors and people in academic medicine. What's the effect of this kind of attitude at the top of the editorial structure?
Yeah, that's what people told me. They said, you know, even a year ago, 2 years ago, I would have been afraid to speak out because I need to publish in JAMA so I can get, you know, a promotion, so I can become a tenured physician. They don't want to risk their positions. But this summer with the pandemic, seeing the unequal amounts of deaths among minorities, and with the death of George Floyd and the social unrest, many black physicians are now saying, like, I have to speak out, and I don't even care if I lose my career, because they've kept us silent for too long.
So what is JAMA telling you? Do they have a plan to fix this?
Well, they're looking into the podcast. They have a committee looking at it with lawyers, and they've said they don't want to comment until they go through that process. The physicians who are holding JAMA's feet to the fire and New England Journal and just medicine in general really are saying, like, you know, they say these journals keep saying, oh, we're going to work on it, we'll review this, and they put up things like Black Lives Matter on their websites. But the physicians, you know, challenging this are saying, we want real action. We want you to tell us what you are going to do and when you're going to do it. And many physicians are already boycotting JAMA and saying they'll send their work elsewhere. And I think this might be an inflection point, and there may be true change.
Usha Lee McFarland, National Science Correspondent for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Thanks for your reporting. We appreciate it. We're going to link to it at hereandnow.org.
Thank you so much.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
On NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, we talk about movies, music, and more, like why The Great Pottery Throwdown is a comforting binge watch, and a look back at some of Chadwick Boseman's essential performances. All of that in around 20 minutes every weekday. Listen now to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
Camden, New Jersey is home to more than 70,000 people, and all those residents have only two public libraries available to them. WHYY's Kenneth Burns tells us now about a woman who's stepping up to fill that gap.
Danielle Jackson is a lifelong Camden resident who loves to read, and she credits her grandmother for instilling that passion within her.
I've always been an avid reader, something that my grandmother, you know, kind of gifted to the family. So all of us are really, you know, heavy into books.
Jackson says while her family helped her understand who she is and where she came from, it was her grandmother's bookshelf that was crucial to her education.
My grandmother has a Black History collection. They are hard copy books, but it's everyone from Maya Angelou to Eartha Kitt to Lena Horne. It is everybody that you could think of on this collection that I've been looking at since I was a little girl.
And while reading in her home in Camden, Jackson says poring over different stories and immersing herself in the adventures helped her travel the world.
I've never been to, you know, Paris or, you know what I mean? I've never been to Africa, but in my mind's eye, I've been to all of those places because I was able to escape there through reading.
Now she shares her love of reading with her community and calls herself the Hoodbrarian.
Like, I want to bring, you know, literacy and resources to the community, and I'm going to do it my way.
She says the inspiration for the name came from Imani Cohen, a Los Angeles-based spiritual entrepreneur who calls herself the Hood Healer. She's also filling a gap in her own community through wellness. Jackson began her mission about 2 years ago after noticing that the city of Camden didn't have as many libraries as it once did.
Well, I looked up one day and all the libraries were closed. We went, you know, from having about 10 to having 2.
The city once managed an extensive public library system, but a budget crisis in the early 2010s prompted city officials to shut the system down and hand over the only two branches left to Camden County. One of the libraries now stands on Ferry Avenue near the south end of the city, and the other on the campus of Rutgers University, Camden. The impact is still felt by longtime residents a decade later.
In the circle that I travel, which are basically a group of active citizens, they all felt as though this is just one more part of the dismantling of Camden.
That's Keith Benson, a lifelong Camden resident and community activist.
They were a place of meeting and a place of learning and one more piece of a very positive culture and a very positive community.
And despite the pandemic's pause on in-person gatherings, Jackson has been able to bring bookworms together virtually. Every Wednesday, she hosts a story time for kids and book club chats for adults.
That's where we have the guest readers and people who want to come on and share that story time with the librarian and friends. Then there's also Raging Readers, which is a book club, and that is from about 11 to maybe 13.
Even if it's just one person, Jackson says she's grateful to share her extensive collection with those who pop into her reading room. Her book selections come from her own library, which she calls her hoodbrary. It's quite sizable thanks to book drives she's hosted and donations from people she knows.
One crate of books could possibly be about 100 books. And so I have about roughly 20 crates of books as of right now.
And that doesn't count the books in her basement or the ones donated by family members. In fact, the latest addition to her hoodbrary are books from her grandmother's bookshelf that sparked her love for reading. And she hopes what those books did for her will do the same for those in her community. For Here and Now, I'm Kenneth Burns.
At this point, more than 3 million people a day are getting coronavirus vaccines. And if you squint into the distance, you might see a day when life gets back to normal. But what does that even mean anymore? On the one hand, I long for things that used to bring me joy, but part of me is also dreading going back to a life that was full of social obligations, work commitments, rushing. Life has changed so much for so many people that the thought of emerging from the pandemic is bringing some of us a mix of joy and apprehension. We heard journalist and author Celeste Headlee talking about some of this recently on NPR's Life Kit podcast. She's a journalist and an author of the new book, Do Nothing, How to Break Away from Overworking, Overdoing, and Underliving. Celeste, welcome. And I wonder if you've been hearing from people who are feeling unsure right now.
I have. A lot of people are feeling really anxious. And it doesn't really surprise me because people feel anxious about small talk always. So when you aren't using your social skills, you know, like any other skill, it's like riding a bike, right? Just imagine that you haven't ridden your bike in more than a year. So be kind to yourself, because when you first jump back on that bike, you might be a little wobbly for a few blocks, but you will get back in the rhythm. And it's kind of that way with social skills. I know that people want to be protective of their alone time and not get overwhelmed. You know, I read somebody tweeted out that, you know, there's going to be a lot of awkwardness now that all those times we've said, oh, yeah, let's meet up after the pandemic, are those, you know, those IOUs are finally coming due. But I know that feels a little bit scary to people. At the same time, those authentic social interactions, that's not what you should be afraid of. Like meeting people in person, those are the kind of things that are actually incredibly good for you biologically and mentally.
You know what I think is really interesting is that I think for a lot of people, relationships have changed a lot in this pandemic. And maybe it's even like the priorities that we have for our relationships. You mentioned the idea of the overdue coffee date that you've been promising for months now. Like in some ways that feels, after all this, like less important. Now, I'm not saying it is, but I'm saying it feels kind of less important than having like a chance to sit down with your elderly parents again for the first time, because we suddenly know what that feels like to not
have
that
available.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I think that's totally correct. You know, if anything else, I hope that people come out of this and are a little more intentional about their social choices. Because in the days before COVID-19, it's quite possible people chose to have the quick coffee with the friend because that was easy and avoided for a really long time having that more lengthy and more meaningful dinner with their grandparents. And I hope that calculus has changed so that people can really think to themselves, okay, I only have a certain amount of social energy. Where should I invest it?
What about work? Celeste, you wrote this book, Breaking Away from Overworking and Overdoing Everything in Life. So many people, if they've been lucky enough to keep their job, have suddenly been presented with this fact that they're not rushing into an office. What about this idea of going back to work?
So this is one of the places in which I'm a little bit pessimistic. And the reason for that is because we kind of doubled down on a lot of unhealthy habits during the pandemic. The early research that we have, the data that we have right now shows that actually people are working more hours during the pandemic than they were before and taking more meetings than they were before. And this is what worries me, is as people get back to work, that they're actually going to sustain these very, very, very unhealthy habits that they've developed, in which they allow work to claim their entire household. Meaning that when people got sick of sitting at their desk at home, they would just pick up their laptop and move to the kitchen, or pick up their laptop and move to the living room, which unfortunately is what you do when you're trying to teach your brain that your entire house is for work. Right? Like when a doctor is trying to teach you, is trying to help you sleep, that doctor will tell you to use your bed for nothing but sleep, because you're training your brain that when it lies down in bed, it's time to go to sleep. Well, when you are working from every corner of your house, you are literally training your brain that when you come home, you're still at work. I really hope that is not going to continue as we come out of COVID-19.
But it might. And it might, because I think a lot of people who are home are going to stay home.
I agree. We really have to establish boundaries. When I was talking about boundaries in terms of your social life, that is especially true with your work life. And I want people to start thinking about this with the kind of intentionality as though they themselves were their own little business that they were listing on Google. Right? If you had to create a business entry for yourself, for Peter, what would be your opening hours and what would be your closing hours? Are you closed on holidays? Are you not? Like, figure out what your schedule is. And during those times when you're not working, don't work. Do not check your email real quick. Don't take a quick peek at Slack. I would suggest staying away from social media if you possibly can, but establish your work hours. This should not make you nervous unless you're super violating this. Are you super violating this, Peter?
Of course I am. Of course I am. And I'd be surprised if you're not either. But you know, here's the answer to your question. You know, I'm a radio broadcaster. My day starts at 4 a.m. and I'm done at 1. And then, you know, the news kind of follows me all day long. So what you're saying is right. But it's tough. It's tough for people. Now, we've been talking about socializing. We've been talking about work. I wonder, just to play devil's advocate here, if we're not sort of like overanalyzing this in a way. Because when I go outside of my home in Phoenix, I see hundreds of people every day who are acting like nothing ever happened. On the other hand, you know, some people have never had the luxury of changing the way they lived in this last year because they had to go to work. At the grocery store, they're risking their lives. And I think for that reason, when we emerge out of this and his life returns to quote unquote normal, do you think it might be hard to relate to one another?
Okay, so there's good and bad news here. I think the good news is that we now have something in common. The bad news is that thing in common is a shared trauma that we have all just been through a really, really tough year. And there's no suffering Olympics. Some people have had harder times than others, but it's been hard for everybody. And so there is common ground in which we can each say to each other when we meet again in the office, wow, what did the pandemic look like for you? How did you get through it? What kind of tips do you have on getting back to some semblance of well-being? Mm-hmm. We can share that conversation, and I hope that we do rather than avoid it. There's also good and bad news when it comes to whether there's going to be more divisiveness, because there will be. So rather than avoiding the conversations that might become arguments, I hope we can learn how to not have arguments and still have the conversation.
tough if you haven't socialized in a while to be walking right into that. Do you think there are things that you're going to try to preserve about your lifestyle over the past year that developed during COVID?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've become very aware before COVID, before my business and my world kind of came to a crashing halt, I really was sort of on autopilot. And I had made rules for myself. I'd established boundaries, but basically, I just kept going. And I think that over the pandemic, because I've been forced to really slow everything down, I have realized how healthy it is to be able to have the kind of flexibility to where if I'm not feeling good, I don't force myself to concentrate. You know, I can focus and really work for 15 minutes at a time and then go take 5 to 10 minutes as a break and then come back to it. You know, the one phrase I wish would die in the fiery pits of hell is rise and grind. Because I feel like we all kind of grind ourselves down. And if there's anything I want to preserve, it's I stopped grinding. There's no more Celeste's nose to the grindstone. Mm-hmm. I take breaks.
As we should. Yeah. Author, journalist, Celeste Headlee, thank you so much. You take the stress right out of conversation, so I do appreciate that.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So where are we in the ongoing story involving Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz? This is not a topic for all ears. It involves a Department of Justice investigation into trafficking a minor for sex, which Gaetz vehemently denies he did, but says the investigation has ensnared him. And then there was the New York Times reporting this week that a few months back, Gaetz asked around in the Trump White House for a pardon for any crimes he may have committed. Yesterday, former President Trump denied Gaetz asked him. And then there are those allegations from congressional colleagues that he enjoyed showing nude pictures of girlfriends while in the House chamber. Gaetz has been one of Trump's biggest defenders, and his rise, sudden stall, and possible fall is being watched closely by Mark Caputo, national political reporter for Politico, based in Florida. He joins us by Skype. And Mark, you call this an only in Florida drama. The DOJ actually started investigating Gaetz's friend, former Seminole County tax collector Joel Greenberg, a guy who once liked to wear a law enforcement badge. He now faces a lot of federal charges. What's the latest on both of them?
The latest is sort of twofold. On Friday, Joel Greenberg's lawyers are going to appear in court, and some of them are telling us that they expect to announce that they're working out a deal with prosecutors. It doesn't mean he's going to plead guilty quite yet. It's a 33-count, wide-ranging indictment. As for Gaetz, he has taken a page from the Trump playbook. He's been very vocal in denying that he is guilty of anything. He has counter-accused the Justice Department of running a smear campaign. On Friday, he's going to be speaking before a Trump-supporting women's group at the Trump Doral National Golf Course here in South Florida. So it gives you an idea of his sort of always-on-offense style.
Yeah, and a lot of people wouldn't even have known about this if it weren't for Matt Gaetz coming out and talking about it so much, saying, in fact, that he and his father were being extorted in a scheme to free a federal agent who disappeared years ago in Iran. It was, you know, his father was said to have borne a wire for the FBI to expose this extortion. The person that he claims was the extorter has completely denied it. By the way, do we know any more about that?
You know, we know dribs and drabs. I mean, the reality probably is that Matt Gaetz' father, the former Florida Senate president, did wear a wire. And there is an indication that that family was approached to provide some sort of financial help to free this spy or this former federal agent who was in Iran or isn't Iran. Most people presume he's dead. It is, as you had mentioned at sort of the intro, sort of an only in Florida story where all of a sudden a wide-ranging corruption and sex investigation somehow becomes an extortion investigation involving Iran and, yes, Israel. So there are all these very strange layers upon layers.
Well, but there's no question that there is a DOJ investigation.
Certainly.
And that Gaetz was caught up in that. And as you said, he just has been, you know, pretty public about it. He went on Tucker Carlson's show on Fox. Carlson had a pretty puzzled look on his face the whole time. And at one point when Matt Gaetz talked about, don't you remember we had a dinner together with me and my girlfriend and you and your wife? And Tucker Carlson said he didn't remember and afterwards called it the strangest interview he'd ever heard. But you mentioned Greenberg's lawyers indicating that they're going to be meeting with officials. Is there a sense that this longtime good friend of Matt Gaetz might somehow turn on him.
Right now, all we're left with is speculation. And if you're Joel Greenberg and you're facing a 33-count indictment that charges you with everything from stalking to money laundering, sex trafficking of a minor, there's a high possibility you're trying to strike a deal. We're getting indications of that. The question is how believable is Joel Greenberg? The original charge he faced that kind of began this broader investigation was he falsely smeared a political rival as a pedophile. So there's almost a Kafka-esque nature of covering this right now, where it's just kind of anonymous allegation after anonymous allegation. And that's one of the things that Gaetz is also pointing out quite clearly, like, hey, look, it's like day eight, day nine. No accusers have come forward. There's no clear, cold, and convincing evidence of what's going on.
Well, then why haven't more of Congressman Gaetz's colleagues come forward to speak up for him?
The reality is Matt Gaetz was a young man in Congress and was known for dating young women. And in Washington especially, that was kind of looked down upon. The broader question is this. Matt Gaetz is not the kind of guy who makes lots of friends. By his own admission, he's in the minority of the minority in Congress. He's had lots of clashes with his own party. A lot of folks don't like him. That's, for instance, a good example of why some of his colleagues have, you know, anonymously said, hey, he showed us this video of, you know, this naked woman doing a hula hoop. The unorthodox behavior or lewd behavior that a lot of people just look down upon. And that's not a good way to get a lot of people to come, you know, rise to your defense. At the same time, no one in his own party is calling on him to resign. No one is publicly presuming him guilty. They're taking more of a wait and see approach.
Mark Caputo, national political reporter for Politico, based there in Florida. Mark, thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.